Soul Talk is a podcast dedicated to making space for Latinx storytellers and content creators across all media to chat about their art, experiences, and culture. As a branch of the Soul Project, Soul Talk welcomes you to the Green Room.
Hi to you both. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting. So we are here to talk about the play El Huracán, which just had its world premiere at Yale Repertory Theater in partnership with the Soul Project. It was a play that we had been working on for a number of years. And maybe just to start, Charisse, I'm going to start with you, who is the playwright, and we're here with Lori Woolery, who is the director and also a founding member of the Soul Project. But to start with you, Charisse, and I know you have been asked this question a lot, which is about the impetus.
Yes.
The impetus for this particular play. You can share that with our listeners.
Sure. The impetus for this play came from a couple of different directions. I have always really loved Shakespeare, and I studied Shakespeare a lot in school, and had kind of taken it on as a project at a certain point as a playwright to kind of like sort of reimagine plays of his from the canon that I really loved with like women in the central roles. So that was one of the main pieces of it. And I just really finished working on and writing this play called Feathers and Teeth. It was a revenge strategy. And I was like, okay, well, it's time to balance the karmic scales and think about forgiveness, which also kind of happened to happen around a time where something really, like a lot of really difficult things had just happened to my family. My grandmother had struggled with and then died of Alzheimer's, and it was just a real upheaval and really hard for my family. And so I kind of put those two things together, and those were the biggest impeti for the play.
Do you think that, because I know that, you know, we went to school together, and so I know you as an actor.
Yes.
You were in the MFA acting program, but then wrote your first play when we were in school together called Estrella, the Junkyard Queen. And one of the things that struck me immediately about your prose and about your aesthetic is that it felt like you were really drawing on the fact that you are an actor, and so the language that you are giving actors feels good in the mouths of actors. Like, it, do you feel like you draw on that in terms of your in terms of you know, how you craft characters and how you craft this particular story?
I think I do. You know, I have to really in order to write anything, I always have to really get to know the characters pretty well first, and then I just sort of listen to them talk and see where it goes. And you know, in rewriting and in like doing edits to my plays, I always try to make sure that it's playable and that it's active, and that I put myself in the shoes of that character and say, okay, do I have something strong and positive to fight for in this part? So I think being an actor really very much informs how I write.
I love that. And Lori Woolery was our director. Lori, can you share with us a little bit about what drew you to the project and how that then sort of guided you in the process of putting this play up?
Sure. I think in some ways it's very similar to what Charisse was just talking about. I mean, I didn't write the play, but I knew the play. Like, I read the very first act of the play, and within pages of reading it, my response was like, well, it's always like, I want to do this, but it's followed by, this has to be done. Like, for the Soul Project, as we were reading it, it was just like, this, we have to produce this. This is the play that the Soul Project has to be behind. And it was easy because like everyone agreed. So it wasn't like I was like fighting an uphill battle, but it is the reason it resonated. And still, I mean, it's still resonating with me, even though the show has closed, is because of the women, because of how it captured the legacy of these Latinas, all from different experiences. They each are walking their journey generationally ahead of their time. And the courage that it takes to do that, and the struggle that it takes to do that, and the trauma that you experience in trying to live an authentic life. And that is my history with my family. And I felt like these women wanted to, they wanted to make their family proud of them. Mm-hmm. Like they knew, they knew, witnessed the struggle, and they wanted to be of service and honor their family, and the women specifically. And I feel that deeply. I wanted to honor what Charisse was putting forth in the world. I wanted to honor those actresses that were like, you know, cutting themselves open. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to honor my family through the telling of it. You know, my grandmother and my tía and my mother. And, you know, I think the thing that's just living in the world, but also just living and has been living with me my entire life, I just now have language for it, is this cultural and historic trauma mm-hmm. that is what we carry on our backs, in our bellies, in our hearts. And now we have language for it where we didn't have it before. And now we have art that is reflecting it where we never had it before. So you can't lead a process going, I have to honor all these people. You just have to like get into it, you know, like roll up your sleeves and like dig into the dark belly of this work, like mm-hmm. our mothers and grandmothers and theas have done before us, and, you know, do the best that we can. And I'm super honored to have been a part of this journey and hope that it continues to have a life. Mm. But I mean, I feel like all of that was carried and still lives within me. Like I can't stop thinking about these characters, and I can't stop thinking about how do they keep finding their way yeah. in other aspects of my life.
I mean, it's interesting. Mm. It's one of the, like when I started writing the play originally, the original title of the play, like it still is on the file on my computer, is Leaving. And so I think another big piece of writing this play for me was about exile. Like my family was, my whole mom's side of the family are Cuban immigrants, and sort of their experience of exile, leaving one place and coming to another, is something that I grew up with and was always in my bones. And so that's a big part of the play, and like how different generations deal with that act of leaving someplace and reinventing themselves somewhere new. And yeah, it's funny, like as we, well, it's not funny, but you know, as we were working on this play, like the whole idea of epigenetics was really fascinating to me, just sort of the like kind of like baggage, cultural baggage that we inherit, that is actually kind of in our DNA on a mm-hmm. cellular level, right? And I still kind of like, I think writing this play was like dealing with that for myself personally mm-hmm. also a lot. And the other big, big piece of it is just how much I love my grandmother. And like this play was for her, is for her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that each of, I won't even just say the female actresses, because I also know that it lived with the men as well in our play, but just what mother holds in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I will also include all those theas who are our mothers too.
Yeah.
They may not be our, we may not come out of them, but just the imprint, like my tía Nena, her imprint on me is as powerful as my mother's, mm-hmm. you know? And, I also just wanted to circle back with this notion of leaving, because that's what this play investigates a lot. But what we also as human beings and artists have had to do is, you know, I had to leave the West Coast to come to the East Coast to discover a different part of me. Yet every day I am haunted by, I should be home with my mother. You know, she's elderly and fragile and aging. And it's like every day that passes is another day that I don't get to be with her, mm-hmm. you know, as the sand of time goes through that vessel. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, my Thea had to leave my grandmother to come here to this country. You know, my grandmother then left her husband and country to come here. So this idea of leaving in order to expand oneself, mm-hmm. Has a price and also opens doors that could not be possible if that courage wasn't there to do so. Mm-hmm. Like, where would I be if my family decided to stay in Central America?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, like my family, every action they took has placed me here to be able to direct a play, to have the freedom to be an artist,
yeah.
to direct a play at Yale Rep, where I always say, like, I wouldn't have gotten into that school. And that's the truth. I'm not being like even like coy or little like humble false humility. It's like, I wouldn't have gotten in. I didn't have the grades, you know, mm-hmm. Because of a wide range of reasons, mm-hmm. but I literally did not have the grades to get into a Yale, but here mm-hmm. I am walking on that campus and creating on that stage with all those master artists. And we are a part of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is really not just, it's humbling, but it's also like, it's about damn time. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
so it's both of those things
yeah.
that, and I think we felt that pressure. You know, I mean, I shouldn't speak for you, but I will say
sure,
that I
yes.
felt like we felt that pressure as a team to hit it out of the park
yeah.
because you don't get those opportunities and those resources. I have felt that my entire life as an artist. It's like, you got it. You better keep that door open for everybody else to be able to come through. So you better prove that
absolutely.
We're worth being there.
Yeah,
absolutely. And maybe just to back up quickly for those who are listening who didn't see the play, maybe if either of you can just do a quick little synopsis in terms of what the play's about.
Playwright?
Sure.
So the very, very most bare bones structure of the play, story of it is that we start in Miami in 1992, right before hours before Hurricane Andrew was going to hit. And we meet Valeria, who is sort of mostly kind of in late stages of Alzheimer's, and her daughter Jimena, and Jimena's daughter Miranda, who is in grad school at Harvard. The first act is the three of them getting ready for Hurricane Andrew and then kind of hunkering down and being in the midst of Hurricane Andrew. And while all this is happening, we're kind of getting snippets of Valeria's life and kind of learning that she was a magician in Cuba, but it's a secret. Her granddaughter Miranda doesn't know that. And then at the end of the first act, Miranda is supposed to be taking care of her grandmother and instead goes to hook up with the guy next door, her childhood love, while she thinks that her grandmother's taking a nap.
Mm.
And then so we flash forward 27 years in the future in the second part of the play. And Jimena and Miranda have had a horrible falling out because of what's happened to Valeria, and they haven't spoken. But Miranda comes back to sort of the morning after another huge storm that takes place in 2019, Hurricane Penelope. So it's a fictional storm that takes place in the future, to discover that her mother Jimena is also kind of in the early stages of Alzheimer's, but really dealing with it in a completely different way than her mother did. So it's about the family kind of breaking apart and then ultimately finding a way back together.
Beautifully done, playwright.
Oh, thank you.
one of the things that I feel like both of you are sort of talking about is this idea of, and Laura, you spoke about it, this cultural trauma that, you know, we bring so much to the work that we do in the rehearsal space. And having been in the rehearsal with both of you, what I marveled at was the way in which you made room for that trauma to come up, that you made room for those actors to really go there and to feel safe and to delve in deeply.
Well,
and
I will say that was all Lori.
I was going to say, yeah, I want to just unpack that a little bit in terms of how,
director.
How did you do that? How did you, because it felt so, you could feel that sort of radiating through the performances. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more about how you made space for addressing that kind of cultural trauma in the artistic process.
I think this year has been a really powerful year for me as an artist, because I've had the privilege of working on two plays by female playwrights of color, Mary Catherine Nagel's Manahara at Oregon Shakespeare Festival and Eludagan by Charisse at Yale. And what I discovered in Manahara, which I was able to then apply and investigate even deeper in El Huracan, is how it's making space, yes, but it's actually partnering with trauma. Trauma as a collaborator, as opposed to ignoring it or trying to contain it or manage it somehow, that you can't actually invite stories, new stories by new playwrights into our field and assume that they have to adhere by the traditional colonial practices. Like, so both Manahara and El Huracan have their own rhythm and energy and cultural aesthetic and, you know, what came up for us in El Huracan is just language, is how when we're, the convention that Charisse and I both walked in, it's like, okay, we're speaking, when they're speaking English together, it's Spanish, but then we started like wanting to make sure that everyone shared the same Cuban dialect when we were speaking the Spanish. But then it just started like, you kept peeling back the layers where it was like, well, you can't do, when we say English, what do we mean by that? Mm-hmm. Who's English? And it's not about accents, it's about a musicality to the words, which then just brought up like, you know, who's English? The traditional practices of like the American standard. What is that? You know, where does that come from? You know, and then plus the history of Cuba and being colonized and recolonized and always like breaking through and trying to decide their own fate. Like that lives in the DNA of the story. Mm-hmm. So to treat it as merely a historic fact and not as part of what is living in the cells and the skin and the blood and the muscle memory of our actors and our playwright and our designers and our director and our producers. Like, it's there. So that's our superpower. So why do we not try to shift how this work is being done? So I would like to say that I was really brilliant and had it all figured out before I even walked into the room, but it's those actors too. Like, they were willing to be that vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we weren't just dealing with like cultural trauma or conquered trauma or family trauma. We were also dealing with environmental trauma. So the anniversary of Hurricane Maria came while we were doing this play.
And that, actors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Designer, stage managers. It's like, it was, you could see it in their eyes. The PTSD of it all was still just there. And, you know, there's that old adage, like, leave it at the door. I've never been a big believer in that. I think there's like certain behaviors you might want to leave at the door, but you can't leave a part of yourself at that door. You have to, if we're wanting them to bring all of themselves, we have to do that. And these plays are inviting us to bring all of ourselves. And because it's a new play, it is only going to deepen, which is why I'm just like lighting candles, praying to the universe and making lots of phone calls of like, the plays have to go on and have multiple lives, because I feel like we are just cracking the second part of the play.
I know.
You know, and it was, I mean, Sharice, you were climbing mountains to just rethink and not have to, you know, like force our way into like, we've got an opening night and we have to force it in. I mean, like, that's the beauty of opening a theater. Like, we do have an opening night, so we have to put something up, but things need time to cook and gestate. And so this is a version of it. Yeah. And then I am just hoping that other theaters will be excited, knowing that it is, not only is it a producible play, it's a play that resonates across experiences, across culture. I mean, we saw the impact, people holding each other, and I mean, Alzheimer's, dementia is cross cultures, religions, classes.
But I also think like family and forgiving family and guilt are things that almost anybody can relate to, you know?
Completely. Yes. I know that for my family, it was so much about that. It was certainly about seeing our elders. You know, Laura, you talked a lot about this in the process, how we're conjuring our elders, conjuring our ancestors. And I think for my family, when they came and saw it opening night, I think the thing that really got them was the thing of forgiveness. You know, what does it mean to really like actively make space to tell the people who are in your lives that you love them and you cherish them and you forgive them, that we are, that being a human being is actually really difficult. And so the deep humanity of the piece is so, I think is the thing that I was just so struck by. And it felt like it was the thing that kind of united us in the rehearsal process in many ways. Sharice,
as the audience.
As the audience, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That became that conversation that was happening even after we left, was what the actors were saying, is how they were interacting with the audience's performance after.
Yes, absolutely. It felt like it really brought like the Yale community together in a way that I think was surprising even for the folks at Yale Rep and at the School of Drama. And it was also just very deeply moving to see the way in which the Latinx community of New Haven also came together, you know, to see their stories reflected on stage in a way that I think hadn't maybe been done in a long time. And that's essentially what the Soul Project is trying to do, right? We are trying to plant seeds for systemic change. So that way, you know, we say these are the stories that should be in conversation with the rest of the canon. I just feel so proud that, you know, Sharice, that you and your, and this play is now a part of the history of Yale Rep. It is in conversation with the American theater. And it's a part of what we are trying to do, which is to build a body of work for the new American theater. That is what we're trying to do. And it feels like El Huracán is such a wonderful kind of testimony example of that, you know.
One of my most profound beliefs is that the stories that we hear and watch and see just shape the way that we understand reality, and it's just a huge mission of mine, like in all areas of my career, to do as much as I can to make sure that the reality that we're shaping through stories that I tell is a good one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to talk actually a little bit more about that, about your career, because you actually haven't been writing for that long, and yet your career has really skyrocketed. And what I'm struck by is not only are you writing these amazing plays for the theater, but you also have a very full life as a television writer. And so I was wondering for the folks listening, if you could maybe talk a little bit about that, because one of the kind of one of the things that I hope this podcast will kind of explore is the intersectionality that our communities are becoming more porous. Like you can work in television, you can work in film, you can work in music, and you can work in the theater. And that the more we bring these communities together, the richer our community will be. And I feel like you're such a great example of that, of having worked in television and also being a playwright. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I have been writing plays since I was in grad school. So I guess I wrote my first play about 10 years ago now. And I've been working in TV for about half that time. So much less time in TV than writing plays. In all the shows that I've worked on, I have always pushed for bigger and more active roles for women and people of color where I can. I produced a pilot years ago on ABC that was, again, about a Cuban American family in Miami, and had like big sort of magical realism pieces to it. Mm. I'm working on a really big project right now, which I can't unfortunately talk about, but that I am most excited about and think is really potentially going to be impactful in a really positive way.
So great.
Yes. So great. That is a film project, so I can say that.
Great. And Lori, for you, your work has been, you know, you were the Associate Artistic Director of Cornerstone Theater. You have expertise in making amazing pieces of art in community. And you're the director currently of Public Works, which is a very expansive, important program of making massive projects of participatory theater with citizens all across New York City. Can you talk a little bit more about how that work of making projects or making art with community also informs your practice as a director?
Yeah, absolutely. I always wanted to be creative. Like as a kid, I would always like lose myself in my imagination. Stories about people were always like, I always wanted to know people's stories and would make up my own if nobody was talking to me about them. But, you know, I could see an old man or woman sitting on a park bench and I would just start sobbing because I had concocted such a sad, tragic life for them that nobody was their friend. They had no family. But I did not actually know that there was a life that could be made out of being a creative being. I was told that literally like, our people, we don't do that. And I accepted that as truth. And it wasn't like my family was trying to be dream, you know, crushers. It's just that was their reality. Is like, we don't have the leisure time to be able to be creative. Totally. Like we need to provide for the family, contribute to the family, make sure that we all have a home that we can live in, we can all get a good education and medical insurance. Like that, those were the goals of my family. But I'm first generation Latinx on my mother's side, and I am the daughter of a farmer from a small town in Texas. And so it's that blue collar immigrant mentality of like, work hard and put your heart and soul in whatever it is that you do and be the best at it. So that's how I was raised. And then I had this active fantasy life. Mm. So it wasn't until the destruction of my family unit that out of the ashes of my family breaking apart, that this phoenix of possibility rose up. And it was like, all bets are off. I'd been being the good, dutiful daughter. And now it's like, now is my time to figure out how to make my way in the world. And so I had no money, I had no training, I had no resources besides, I think, my family's spunk, you know, and that courage we were talking about, from that ancestral courage and tenacity. And there's always that part of me that when it was like, no, our people don't do that, I was like, okay. But the deeper voice inside me was like, why? So that why has always been the big engine that has driven me forward. So I scrapped it together. It was like, oh, I'm serious about being an artist, but I don't know what that looks like. Ran into an old friend who was taking classes at South Coast Repertory. And I'm like, that's my secret hidden fantasy dream that I couldn't actually put a name to. I'm gonna go there and take a class. Being at South Coast Repertory, took my first acting class, saw my first professional play there, became the first non-equity gig there, turned union there, started, but wanted to learn. So I was always just like at that building going, what else is going on? What else can I volunteer for? What can I do? And met Jose Cruz Gonzalez, who was starting this program that was going out into community and offering free acting classes to the kids out in Santa Ana. And I was like, oh, I'll come help you. And 120 kids showed up for a class for 20 people. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, Jose, we're going to have to turn away 100 kids. What are we going to do? How are we going to pick them? What are we going to do? And he's like, hey, give me a second. Okay, this is what we're going to do. You're going to take half of them. I'm going to take half of them. We're going to divide up the hours this way. And I'm like, I'm not a teacher. I don't know what to do. He's like, you know more than they do. Okay. And he just started counting people off. And in that moment, what he modeled for me was there is always a creative solution. Mm. Like, don't get stuck with your plan. Live in the moment and serve the moment. So by doing that, my world exploded and community became my grad school. So the work that I put into those libraries and community centers and cafetoriums in Orange County and all those outlier communities, as well as inside at South Coast Rep running their program, is the same passion, integrity, drive, ambition that I bring to my community productions at Cornerstone, the community pageants at the Public Theater, to my productions at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Yale Rep, etc. Like, to me, it's about exceptional art making in a respectful environment that makes people feel safe to take a risk, because that's what I needed. Mm. So that, sometimes I don't know what it is and it's nerve-wracking, but I just remember that if you are living in the moment with the people that you are in a room with, only good stuff can come out of it, even when it's hard. And so to me, it's not like it's different, it's the same. And just community is community of incarcerated women or community of Latinx actors at Yale, or a community of people in, you know, a milling town in Eureka, California, to 200 people at the Delacorte Theater. Like, it's the same, but it has to be your best art making every single time.
Yes.
Like, you, nothing is charity. Nothing is like a side gig. Nothing is lesser than. It is all about bringing the best of yourself and wanting the best and wanting to be better than your last production.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
and I feel like what you're also speaking to, which I love, you know, in your art making, is really knocking down the misconception that to be, you know, to do the work of building community or making art with community somehow means that it's not excellent or that you don't strive for excellence. And what you have demonstrated is that it is absolutely artistically excellent, and that's actually a part of its vitality. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you just said that reminded me of, I'm reading this book called Emergent Strategy.
Yes, such a good book.
Brown. Uh-huh. And the thing that she talks about is, what's the magic that you can create with the people that you have in your circle? What is the conversation that only this group of people can have? What is the magic you can create with this constellation of humans? And so I think when you enter into an artistic process, like, you know, putting up a new play, it's like, okay, what's the magic? What's the alchemy that can be created with mm-hmm. this group of actors? And what I felt so strongly was that the two of you absolutely made that happen with Ed Huracan.
It is interesting that you say that, because at Cornerstone, we would always say that, you know, we would do story circles and gather stories from community.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never know who's going to show up, if anybody's going to show up. But if one person shows up, it can still be a great event.
Yes.
You know, and so that is like, but I love thinking of that, because sometimes we can start attaching attendance or abundance to success. Mm-hmm. And I think this work is, this is me. I just think everything needs to be hand-stitched. Like, you just can't mass produce things. Like, and that's the beauty of theater, is it's all in real time. So like, you are living and breathing with that audience in that moment, and they're feeding you always, whether they're verbal or they're not verbal. Mm-hmm. You know, and so how do you take that, and how is that alchemy? How is that conversation happening in real time?
Yeah.
You have to set up your actors to be able to trust the choices that we've made, trust the story that we're telling, and not get scared to back off and do something to get a response to make sure that people are listening, but to actually sit in that silence. Because I think this play, it was a lot of that moment where people don't know how to respond because they are seeing their grandmother or grandfather or mother or father. They're seeing that Alzheimer's or that dementia, that caregiving, and people were holding their breath because it's like suddenly their life was being revealed to them on stage.
That's right.
And they were able to enter into what I also thought you did so beautifully, Charisse, is entering into a world that you're so dying to know where your family member is going. Mm-hmm. Are they still there? If they don't know my name, do I even exist? Does our relationship, our family even exist? And I think that trust of being able to go, oh, if you're really present, sometimes you will get the smallest sign. And I believe that in art making, I believe that in community building, I believe that in an artistic partnership, and I believe that in the relationship between the story, the actors, and the audience, that is the magic of what theater provides that I think other like TV and film don't. Because you're having to breathe and dream and risk and experience something collectively.
Yes. So beautifully said, Lori. So maybe just a final question. You know, it feels like the American theater is very much in a time of reflection and transformation. And I'm just curious to hear from the two of you about what's sitting in your heart and mind in terms of what feels inspiring to you, what feels kind of hopeful as you think about the future of the field and of the artistic landscape. What's exciting to you as you think about the future of our art form?
Gosh, there's so much.
Yeah.
I think there's so many amazing, new, wonderful young playwrights that are coming up. It's really exciting to people like to you see and hear plays where it's very clear that people are coming from like a perspective that I haven't seen or heard before. I think theater is becoming more inclusive, and people are getting used to seeing very different stories on stage, and those stories are doing really well, are successful commercially also, which is exciting because that's always, you know, something we have to take into consideration.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I do think like in a time when there's over 400 different TV shows on across all platforms at any given time, the fact that like we still have this desire to make and create theater because it's a completely unique art form because of a lot of what you were saying, Lori, it's beautiful. It's really inspiring to me.
That's great. Lori, how about for you?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. And I think what I'm excited and nervous about, which is I think like the same feelings I have whenever I walk into a rehearsal room for the first time, is the not knowing, because new artistic leadership is on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And I also believe that new models of leadership are starting to emerge and have to emerge, which is really exciting to me to see how this moment in the history of American theater will be looked at. And so I just really think about that a lot, is how do we contribute to that shift? How do we help tee things up for the next generation? How do we support our master writers and artists, as well as our mid-level, as well as our emerging, and where I feel like we're all starting to live a little bit more in the idea of shared abundance as opposed to scarcity, and a unification as opposed to a fighting for. Mm. Like there's only one play in a season for a director of color, like, or playwright of color, like that is starting to shift. So I'm excited and nervous about that. And personally, I'm just very, like, I'm so thrilled by the work that is coming out of our playwrights. Like, I just feel like, we need that as our roadmap. And I just feel like this year I've been really pushed and challenged in ways that I couldn't have master planned. So that is, keep writing, playwrights, you know, keep writing, ladies, you know, keep producing at an American theater, because it is, it's expanding all of us. I think all of the actors, the designers, would all say the same thing, is that they were pushed far outside of anything that they thought was possible. You know, and I think that some of these plays, maybe I'm not doing anybody a favor by saying this, but both of the plays this year that I directed had producers saying, I don't know if it's a producible play. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like mic drop moment. It's like, not only was it both of these producible, but they thrived and they affected audiences. So that means we get to break open this idea of what we think is producible.
Amen.
I'm theater makers. Like, we're magic makers. Like, yeah, that's what we do. So let's not limit it. Let's blow it open.
And on that note, thank you both so much.
Thank you
for
being our first two guests as we launch this new podcast, Soul Talk. And thank you, listeners, for joining us.
Thank you, listeners.
And we'll be back soon with episode 2.